Broadcast of the Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series is made possible in part by Proliance Energy. Proliance, adding power to energy. Information is at proliance.com.
The opinions and commentary expressed in the following presentation did not reflect the views of this station, the Economic Club of Indiana, or the Economic Club's agents or sponsors. Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana. The speaker this month is David Johnson. He's the CEO of BioCrossroads. Its mission is to serve as a catalyst for the continued growth of Indiana's robust life sciences industry. Johnson says the Midwest economy is reviving because of more emphasis and investment in the life sciences. Indiana ranks in the top five nationally for the number and concentration of life sciences careers.
I am a huge fan of the Economic Club. This is a real honor for me to have the opportunity to be here, and I'm a huge fan of this community as well. And so, although I appreciate very much Jim's kind introduction and reference to BioCrossroads, and I'll be very happy to talk about BioCrossroads in the Q&A session, I'm actually not going to talk about BioCrossroads in my talk today, but rather talk about some other places that I think have some very good lessons for us. And I'd like to start with a reference to a book that many people have read in the economic development area, many people quote, that I find difficult and disagreeable often, but it is highly quotable, so I will use it throughout this talk. It's a book called Caught in the Middle, and it was written a couple years back by Chicago Tribune reporter Richard Longworth. And it has a great deal to say about the Midwest, and essentially about the Midwest being in many ways a victim of its own success in the new era that we live in today. Longworth talks about at one point that this was the Silicon Valley of the industrial era, and that the Midwest was the place where half of everything that was made here. But today, of course, when most things are no longer made in America, Longworth finds that the Midwest has become the region that prizes stability when all the rest of the world is about change. Only the Midwest could have had the stubborn and, Longworth argues, woefully misplaced confidence to inspire and actually find beauty in a painting like that one. And this plays a prominent role in his book. In 1930, the artist Grant Wood passed through Eldon, Iowa, a village in the southern part of that state, and saw a white wooden house, a graceful, simple place with five rooms, built in 1881 in the style called at that time Carpenter Gothic. Back home in Cedar Rapids, Wood painted the house from a photograph. In front, he posed his sister, Nan, and his dentist, who he really must not have liked. Dr. Byron McKeeby is the guy with the pitchfork there. So this is the iconic image of much of the 20th century rural Midwest, and so in a different way was the town of Eldon that inspired it. The house, I guess, if Longworth is accurate, is still there. It's at the edge of town, but the rest of the town isn't much. It used to have 2,000 people, a brick bank, doctors, grocery, railway station, opera house, and today has far fewer than 1,000 people, mostly shuttered stores, few auction houses, pretty much the land that time forgot. A victim of the same forces that have devastated so many Midwestern towns and cities, forces we all know far too well. Globalization, abandoned factories, fewer family farms, loss of the railroad, migration of jobs, and ultimately the migration of people and opportunity. In the face of these unprecedented labor, housing, business, population dislocations, you can either be someone like Longworth who sort of revels in this and really gets into talking about how bad it is here, or a city or a region can decide they want to try to do something about it and begin to ask the question of how to stay relevant. In the Midwest, where we are so humble and so modest about our identities, how do we create something exciting? How do we attract jobs and skilled workers, become a cool place to lead technology and industry trends? And how can the Midwestern region that, again, according to Longworth, keeps waiting for that return to the bygone era of stability, ever muster the creative energy to seize change instead? There are many questions, but there may be the beginning of a few answers too, and I think there are. And that's the topic of my talk here today. Because there are some Midwestern cities that have not joined Eldon, Iowa, in economic decline, that are not standing still, but are building on their strengths to pursue a very different kind of success for the future. In talking about this and giving the examples, which I want to get into in a moment, I do want to make clear from the outset that none of these communities has come up with a perfect or even a completely comprehensive solution by a long shot. These are all works in progress. There are many people who are not participating, and they all have a lot of room for improvement. But they are progress and not decline, and there are helpful lessons to be learned from looking at them. Before I turn to those examples, I want to acknowledge the city that I'm in, because I'm hoping there's a lesson of some value in all this for South Bend. I know a lot of you here have spent a great deal of time here, and I know that South Bend is no Eldon, Iowa. The growth of communities like that in the past hinged on agriculture and primarily being followers of other people's markets and trends. This is a community that was built by doers. South Bend was built by entrepreneurs and innovators. By the middle of the 19th century, it was pretty clear that this was a community that was going to be wildly successful, and it has been. Whether we're talking about Studebaker or Singer or the South Bend Lathe Works or Bendix, this is a history with a tremendous industrial, entrepreneurial, and commercial legacy. What's next? What will the 21st century be for a community like this one with such great strengths when it comes to entrepreneurs? How will past skills translate into future opportunities? They're hard questions, and they're not just hard in this community, they're hard everywhere. The success today is also making this harder, even more challenging to come by, because not only the incidence of global competition for talent and markets and advantage, but also because we are at a time when it is very difficult to poke our heads up above the current economic dislocations and really talk about thinking strategically for the future. In Indiana, we are a lot better off than our neighboring states. But still, the unemployment rate in this state hovers stubbornly at 10% or thereabouts, and South Bend's is not far behind. And South Bend and Indiana are not alone. The Pew Research Center recently reported that more than half the nation's workforce has been hurt by the recession, and I suspect that number is woefully out of date. 55% of Americans have either been laid off, taken a pay cut, or been compelled to take unpaid leave, forced into part-time work. It's tough to talk about strategy when you're talking about putting food on the table. Still, many cities and regions and the ones that have tried to have a strategic approach, even to this recession, have tended to do better at this time than those that have not. And really the secret to this, and the examples we'll talk about, is looking to the future, but also being very focused on what has made a community great and successful in the past. For example, this is my thesis at least here, if City A got great by making stuff, then City A's future is probably also going to involve making stuff, just better stuff or newer stuff or more highly engineered stuff than in the past. If City B has traditionally had an economy driven by healthcare and hospitals, then the chances are really, really high that healthcare and hospitals are going to drive City B's economy in the future too. Even though they'll be different, there'll be different kinds of facilities, they'll need to bring in more revenues through innovation and new products and services. And if City C was a trailhead 100 years ago for cattle, tied to the farm, tied to the land, then you can bet the best bet for City C going forward is also going to have something to do with farms and animals. But this time it could be biotech companies for animal health or discovering corn seeds resistant to drought. For communities across this region, opportunities rooted in history offer even today a legacy of skill, talent, and concentrated resources. This is rich soil for innovation and hard work. And those resources are not obsolete. In fact, they represent often the foundations for the future. But for communities to realize that future, they need to be smart, they need to be well-led, There needs to be passion and a readiness to have a new game plan every time complacency and cynicism starts to creep in. The emerging stories of Midwestern success, I believe, have at least three things in common. First, each of the communities that I'm aware of in this model has taken, at some point, usually kind of early on, an objective, unsentimental inventory of particular industry or occupation strengths and assets. Not what we would like to have, but what we have always been good at. An expensive little secret on this is that often this effort is best done by going out and getting somewhat costly consultants to come in, because there's a lot of tough love in this message in terms of what people are good at and what they're not. And it's often easier to have someone that you're paying a lot of money to from out of town tell you that news. The second, in each of these communities, the leaders in local and regional governments and businesses and universities, community organizations, have come together around a common mission, one that they feel compelled and passionate about, to collaborate for success. The notion that everybody gains advantage by everybody getting opportunity. And third, the communities that I'm thinking of have worked to build and keep adapting an economic development strategy that is not static, and it is not simply a strategy, but it's based on things that people have been good at doing and then has to adapt as they start doing them in new and different ways. Once a community's found a strategy that's right for it, it will change, but the commitment to implementing it and finding the money to move it ahead is a great place to start. So let's look at a few examples besides Eldon, Iowa. I'll take another glamorous place, and that's Cleveland, Ohio. Cleveland, Ohio. Yes, the place where the river caught on fire in the 1970s. And everybody wondered in the 1990s, how in the world could a city like that get the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? Again, thinking what I said at the beginning of this, Cleveland still has lots of problems and challenges. But beyond aging rock stars, it's also got some very, very smart and dedicated people working on some interesting and creative solutions. Many of these center around healthcare, which today is probably Cleveland's greatest asset. The region is home, of course, to the world-renowned Cleveland Clinic. The clinic itself brings in tens of thousands of, we now call them medical tourists, but essentially people seeking therapy in cardiovascular care and cancer every single year. Adding to that foundation, the Cleveland Clinic, which has become probably the world's leading healthcare destination along with the Mayo Clinic, is cited for its research and its clinical strengths. And those strengths are shared with Case Western University and University Hospitals, which compete, but which together are building a vibrant cluster of innovation and commercial activity in a very tough, blighted area, traditional downtown Cleveland. Over the last several years, there's been a sharp increase in that community in investment dollars, grant funding, numbers of startups, licensing revenues, technology transfer deals. These people are very insistent on hard metrics, and they've got them. It's all come about through the collaborative efforts of Cleveland area leaders, from foundations and institutions and businesses, and from the philanthropic and governmental side that have really made this happen. The region's institutions conduct $500 million annually in healthcare research, which is a lot. And they've collaborated to win significant state and federal awards to create and grow new national centers of healthcare excellence. There are now more than 500 firms producing goods and providing services to the healthcare industry located in the Cleveland region. Medical device firms are more than half of that number. But there are also other healthcare service firms and biotechnology firms in the mix too, drawing on the region's strengths in advanced materials and electronics and cardiovascular care. Together, these firms now employ 20,000 well-paid and skilled people across the region, and again, in the heart of an area that was written off as blighted 25 years ago. One reason the Cleveland area is so successful in healthcare is an organization called BioEnterprise, which we really view as one of our principal counterpart organizations in the United States today. It's a great group. It develops ideas into promising biomedical companies. It's got a professional staff of close to 50, and these folks provide wonderful resources, technology transfer assistance, venture development and venture capital introductions, all kinds of connections to the types of opportunities and people that you need to plan and grow new companies. And so since 2003, there have been 90 healthcare startups in the greater Cleveland area. And they've attracted nearly $1 billion in new equity funding, not all of it from Cleveland, from all over the United States, coming to Cleveland to help build these companies. That's quite an accomplishment for a city that many people wrote off a number of years ago as a place that time forgot. Although the Cleveland Clinic and BioEnterprise have had a lot of influence in energizing the city, helping it focus on new ways to build the economy, again, the region still has many challenges, even beyond LeBron James. The LeBron James challenge probably cannot be addressed, but the other ones can be. And they're doing a tremendous job in making that effort and making it in an excited, energized, and passionate way. There are other people doing this too. Kansas City, for example, is doing many of the right things when it comes to identifying key strengths and collaborating for success, even though the terms of that success are radically different. Kansas City, you talk here about Michiana, Kansas City enjoys both the strengths and the disadvantages of being a city on a border between two states. It began life as a transportation center and a gateway to Western expansion in the 1850s. In 1871, the Kansas City stockyards were established and grew to be the nation's second largest livestock market and processing center. Kansas City was once called the place where people grew the beef, tended the beef, and served the beef. You know what's next. So now there's more, though, to Kansas City than simply an answer to the question, where's the beef? Today, Kansas City is the center of an animal health corridor, and it's a term they have branded and defined, and they should, because this, in fact, is a corridor of opportunity that spans a good chunk of Kansas and goes into Missouri, and it hosts the largest single concentration of animal health companies in the world. Fully 32% of this $20 billion industry is based in the Kansas City region. Three of the five animal nutrition companies are there, Mars Pet Care, Nelson, and Hills Pet Nutrition. Four of the top 10 animal health companies call Kansas City home, including Bayer, Bioimmune, and Intervet Shearing Plow. The animal health corridor today boasts 13 new startups every year, three major company expansions recently, 1,200 new jobs, a $60 million payroll, and nearly $1 billion in new capital investment. Why has all this come together in Kansas City? It has been collaboration, and again, collaboration with some interesting challenges because it's having to take place across political lines. So it means that collaboration can't just be driven by one government. One of the organizations responsible for coordinating and overseeing the region's life sciences efforts is non-governmental, but more focused on research, and that's the Kansas City Area Life Sciences Institute. That group works to advance research, commercialization, and workforce development, and it's joined by many other efforts. The state legislatures in both Kansas and Missouri have actually been helpful. They have passed legislation that allows the two states to work together. Again, no small task, considering the stakes that are always involved in two states collaborating. But there has been the Kansas Economic Growth Act of 2004, the Kansas City Bioauthority Act in 2005, which has produced $700 million in tax increment to fund the growth of the Kansas Life Sciences Initiative and specifically the Animal Health Corridor, and the Missouri Science and Innovation Reinvestment Act. The Animal Health Corridor Initiative came from the Kansas City Area Development Council, who actually put these facts together, again, took inventory, went and looked at what they had, and were surprised when they found out what they really did have in animal health and started paying attention to it. So Kansas City's figured out a collaborative strategy that reaches across political boundaries and is truly making change happen. So let's come a little closer then to home and look in our own backyard or close to it up the road at Warsaw, Indiana. Like South Bend, Warsaw began life in the 1800s as an entrepreneurial community. Early Warsaw was home to traders and trappers and merchants supplying goods to area farmers. The fertile land and ready proximity to water also turned the area into a rich agricultural district. Many lakes drew tourists, and religious and cultural Chautauqua events led people to make permanent homes in the city, and industry soon followed. When traveling pharmaceutical salesman Reverend Depew, yes, there really was a Reverend Depew, first arrived on the scene in Warsaw in 1894. It was a bustling market town, railroad center. Warsaw is also, by the way, one of the worldwide homes for duck production. A lot of things going on there. But he was interested in the revival meetings because it was a great place to do business. And he found his way there and found a whole bunch of prospective patients who were interested in patent medicines and miracle cures and other things. And as the story goes, Depew learned in the course of talking with people that when physicians at that time were setting fractures, broken legs, they were doing it always with wood splints that were made from barrels, which had some advantages but also some disadvantages because the wood splints had splinters in them, and they often lodged under the patient's skin and caused infections. It's amazing to think about that, but that's actually what was going on. And so this guy, who was not only a salesman but a fair engineer, developed a solution that gave birth actually to the entire orthopedic industry today. He invented a fiber and then a wire and a splint. And then he reached, mercifully, a very good decision. He decided that Warsaw was such a great place to do business that he was going to live there. So he ended up setting up in Warsaw's Hotel Hayes, Depew, and early on he went out and hired a guy named Justin Zimmer to work for him as a splint salesman. Very successful, but arguably very ungrateful. Zimmer seized opportunity and left Depew after a few years to start his own orthopedic company, which he named after himself, following in Depew's footsteps. And of course today Zimmer is the largest orthopedics company on the planet. A more modest Dane Miller in 1977 left Zimmer to set up Biomet. And those three companies in Warsaw, Indiana today are among the top five orthopedics companies in the world, all because of Reverend Depew coming to a Lake Revival meeting. Aside from Depew and Zimmer and Biomet, there are 42 other medical equipment and device companies in Warsaw, including spinal implant companies like Medtronic, startups like Orthopediatrics, and major suppliers like Paragon and Symmetry. Collectively, Warsaw's orthopedics enterprises earn over $11 billion in annual revenues. They represent more than half of the U.S. market shares in that little community, and more than a third of the global market is in Warsaw, Indiana. So it's no surprise that Warsaw is today known as the orthopedics capital of the world. And going back to our keynote book, Richard Longworth's Caught in the Middle, even that guy recognized that Warsaw was kind of different from some of the other things that he was talking about. So he grudgingly says that Warsaw is, and I'm quoting here, an astonishing little town that thrives by doing what it's always done and doing it better than anyone else in the world, which is sort of the right strategy. But it's not a strategy without challenges. In September of last year, thanks to the generosity and foresight of our colleagues at Lilly Endowment, who do many, many wonderful things for communities all over this state, our organization, BioCrossroads, was asked to come up to Warsaw and carry out a comprehensive study, looking at the region, looking at the community, looking at the industry, seeing how the productivity on this landscape could be maintained, and trying to assess the threats and the challenges to it going forward. What we found, of course, was an industry that in a town of fewer than 20,000 people produces 6,000 direct jobs, plus service jobs in companies supporting the orthopedics industry. So this is probably the most concentrated cluster of economic activity anywhere in the U.S. It was not designed to be that way. It was not a governmental policy to create it to be that way, but it is that way. And so the future of the Warsaw community will be about orthopedics, for better or for worse. No matter what happens to the industry, the community is tied to it. And that's a good thing, because it's a very profitable business. It's increasingly research-intensive. Zimmer, for example, has more than 800 researchers who are working in Warsaw. There are, I think, 30-some sponsored research partnerships with institutions like Notre Dame and Purdue. But Warsaw faces some challenges, and the industry that it's a part of faces challenges too. Education and training challenges in the workforce. Increasingly, this kind of workforce must be talented, must be diverse, must be recruited from all over the world. It's not easy always to recruit a global population to come to Warsaw, Indiana. Talent, 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 which drives all of these things, becomes the big rate-limiting factor. Transportation is also tough. If you come from the part of the state that I do, getting to and from Warsaw, Indiana, is a challenge. It's not easy. It's not easy to get products and people in and out. And there's an increasing need among newer and smaller companies to have access to innovative research, new technologies, and money. And then the last thing I should mention is, of course, that the federal government discovered how profitable the medical device business is in passing the health reform bill and has imposed a new medical device tax, which will affect all of the companies in Warsaw and make a have a big impact on where they decide to employ people and where they decide to have facilities and operations. The community in the past was able simply to allow the companies to be there and for all the rising tide to lift all boats. But increasingly going forward, that community recognizes that it's going to require a deliberative, collaborative strategy built around the orthopedics companies, but more than the companies, to make a better and stronger community. And so it has begun to work with local colleges like Grace College, with Ivy Tech, and through a very generous $7 million grant from Lilly Endowment, the companies in the community have founded an organization called OrthoWorks, which I hope you've heard of. We're very proud of what's happened there. We've been a part of that effort. It's a new industry, community, and education initiative designed to do the things we're talking about here, to provide a strategy, to think about how to make it a more livable community, how to attract, educate, and retain talent, how to sponsor, promote, energize, and excite people about innovation. And it's really working, because the people in the community and in the companies have found that this is a timely initiative for them. It's about them. It's something they can participate in. The board of directors includes a who's who list of company leaders and others who are driving forward the community in education, workforce training, and community enhancement. It's a lot of opportunity there, and a lot of opportunity in the orthopedic sector. But going forward, it will not happen unless it's deliberate, focused, and strategic. So let's come back here. Let's come back to South Bend, because you're part of this picture, too. South Bend and the city's what I think is your greatest asset in this community, the University of Notre Dame. It's exciting to see, just in the time that I've been at BioCrossroads and working with the community and with Notre Dame, how increasingly closely this community and this great university are working together and designing initiatives to create new businesses and job opportunities in the city, in the county, and a very strong engagement with the state. Since the research coming out of Notre Dame is so strong, thanks to Bob Bernhardt and Peter Kilpatrick and others here today, the university and community partners are focused on the right kinds of commercialization efforts. You know them well. I'll mention just a few. The Midwest Institute for Nanoelectronics Discovery, or MIND, at the university, one of only four of its kind in the U.S., part of an industry, an emerging industry that the National Science Foundation estimates will be worth $1 trillion in less than 5 years. This is the intel inside that effort, and it's right here in South Bend. Innovation Park is another collaborative effort among the university, city, and the state. It's a great, great facility. Research from the university can find a place to incubate and grow, but it's about more than just the university, too. This certified technology park has not even celebrated its first birthday, but it already has several companies, several of whom are represented here today, that are growing and thriving there. And though based more on commerce than science, the development of Eddy Street Commons is another example of how the campus and community are coming together around a common purpose. Cleaning up an area that needed it, needed an economic boost, benefiting the neighborhood and student life, and providing some really good places to go to lunch. Under the leadership of Father John Jenkins and Provost and BioCrossroads board member Tom Burrish, Notre Dame, which has always been a world-class institution, has truly become a first-class citizen of this community and this state. And the presence of that collaboration is evident everywhere, and so is the energy. Bringing all those resources together and keeping them that way, keeping the excitement and keeping the energy focused, is what will make this city and this community, and ultimately the state, positioned to win. And it's about winning. Turning back to the book one last time, Caught in the Middle, the author, Richard Longworth, writes that a century ago, Midwestern might was based on easy access to iron and coal, to money, to railroad transport, to new methods of mass production. But mostly, he says, and this is kind of surprising he reaches this conclusion, the success of this region rested on ideas, on the minds and imaginations of a generation of entrepreneurs, dreamers, and doers, unafraid to risk all on a roll of the industrial dice, and people who knew how to work hard when they found opportunity. Midwestern innovation and Midwestern energy created a whole new world. And so his conclusion in this otherwise somewhat dismal book is that, in fact, the American future may not belong to California or Massachusetts or Las Vegas or Orlando. He says it may very well lie where it has always lain, in the heartland, the battered bellwether, in the very middle of the country. I think he's right. 80 years ago, American Gothic might have been an accurate, if not terribly flattering, picture of the Midwest. But no more. We're going for a trade-in. Still one ugly dentist, though. But we're gaining on it. The painting's being replaced by a new picture, a portrait that can show the Midwest at the center of an American Renaissance. Bring this Renaissance about in the Midwest, in Indiana, and in South Bend, is going to take a really strong commitment to collaboration and an understanding of what has been and what can be to win in a whole new world. Individuals and organizations used to going it alone must come together and plan together and work that way. They must identify what they're really good at and exploit greatest shared assets and do it for the good of all. So what are South Bend's? Is it nanotechnology? Is it electronic medical information? Is it bioscience? Is it healthcare? Is it something altogether different? Although I suspect it will be related to engineering and making things. But is it something else? Right now, this community is discovering the answers to those questions. Working together, it's an exciting time here because there's a really strong feeling of a dynamic future for this community and this region, joining others in this Midwestern Renaissance. You'd be happy to know that in the 40th anniversary issue of Smithsonian Magazine, just came out, there's an article that says 40 things you need to know about the next 40 years. And prediction number 11, don't know why it isn't higher up the list, but prediction number 11 is the heartland will rise again. Joel Kotkin, who is writing a book on population explosion, writing in a new book called The Next 100 Million, contends that not since the 19th century, when the heartland was a major source of America's economic, social, and cultural supremacy, has the vast continental expanse been set to play so powerful a role in shaping the nation's future. Now, there is at least one author who does get it, someone who already has a sense for some of the things that are happening in places like Cleveland and Kansas City and Warsaw and Indianapolis and South Bend, things that will continue to happen here if we work on it. So let's get busy, and let's all keep scraping more and more of that rust off our Midwestern belts. Thanks very much. I'll be happy to take any questions.
Seems like nearly every city and state in the country has a life sciences initiative. And one would assume that not all of these can be successful. But listening to your remarks and the various, and taking a broad view of that term, perhaps with the various combinations, there may be a number of, maybe enough niches for everyone. How would you view that? And I think maybe this is just an extension of what you were recommending in every community, trying to be pretty specific in identifying its strengths and weaknesses.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate that question. The point I'm really trying to make, and it obviously is the point of our organization as well, BioCrossroads as well, when we started BioCrossroads in the early part of this decade, believe it or not, it was before every community in the country was trying to have a life sciences initiative. Biotechnology And the Bio Association was not drawing 20,000 people to its meetings at that time. It was not yet the cool thing to do. We ended up focusing on biotechnology and life sciences because we had so much of it. Indianapolis is the ninth largest center of biotechnology employment in the country. So going back to what I'm speaking about, we would have been stupid, frankly, not to look at having a biotechnology and life sciences initiative. But the problem that we were trying to solve and still are in that area is that although we had roughly 30,000 people employed in biotechnology companies and pharmaceutical companies in central Indiana, they were all employed in about 10 places, whereas the people of about 30,000 in the San Diego area also has about 30,000 people working in that sector. But they were employed in about 500 companies. What's the difference? We had old line, traditional, vertically integrated companies, which Lilly, for example, was in those days. It isn't anymore, but it was then, even just a decade ago. And so we were at risk as a region and as a community of losing our assets if one or two or three of those companies went away. When Guidant got acquired, that was a big problem for us. If you're in San Diego, if a company gets acquired, if it gets merged, if it moves on, someone else comes and takes their place. And what we were trying to do was to figure out how to build on the strengths we had to use that as the seed corn for growing new ones. In doing that, and we had a lot of expensive consultant surveys to guide us in this effort too, but in doing that, you had to pick the right stuff to go after. There are all kinds of life sciences and biotechnology opportunities that we are not involved in. We will not pursue them. It's not because they're not worthy. It's not because they wouldn't advance the cause of human health. It's just that we're not especially good at them. We have no legacy of having been in those areas. But when it comes to certain types of cardiovascular care, when it comes to cancer, when it comes to diabetes, when it comes to diseases of the central nervous system, we are great at that stuff. We have a corporate and university culture in that part of the state that has been active in those areas for years and has brought tremendous numbers of new products to market in those areas for years. And so as the market moves on in those sectors, we need to be figuring out how to find and supply new companies to feed it, and that's what we've been involved in. So short answer to your question is, you don't look over your shoulder at what other people are doing. You look right in your own backyard to what you have been good at doing in the past and figure out where the external pressures of the world are going to force businesses in the future. Are they going to force them to be smaller? Are they going to force them to be more partnered? Are they going to force them to be more networked? Are they going to force them into outsourcing solutions? All of those things are part of the new economy. But the old assets can work in it if we're smart about it.
Thank you. Related to that, in addition to what's happening in Warsaw, what are some of the most exciting developments happening today within Indiana's life sciences sector?
I think the most, and you're going to see it here if you're not already seeing it here, the most exciting thing that we're seeing is that the folks who pulled our life sciences effort together, which is, and you're a part of it, were right when they believed that there were, in fact, some very promising new ideas, some very promising companies, and that if you added the right kind of talent and the right kind of market and venture capital to them, you could really start and grow new companies coming forward. We've helped to start 25 biotechnology companies here in Indiana so far. That's not a huge number, but they're all hard, and they get easier. Each one you get going. You will see that happen here now, too, with Innovation Park, with what the University of Notre Dame is doing and with its technology transfer, with the close relationship the university has with the School of Medicine. And watching those companies take root and watching the excitement that comes from those really tells you that we can do it.
This is about BioCrossroads.
Okay.
Okay. Why was BioCrossroads' first important project? The one that made you believe that this is really going to take off?
Probably, and this, again, has some resonance here. I'm looking for Phil Newbold right there. Probably the first thing that really convinced us was founding the Indiana Health Information Exchange. And that's a good, quick example to provide here. We knew that we had developed, 40 years ago, a guy named Sam Regenstrief figured out that if you matched digital technology with appliances, it worked. So he was the first person to put digital controls on a dishwasher, and he made a lot of money doing that. And he left most of that money to Indiana University and to the Reagan Street Foundation and later the Reagan Street Institute, which in the 1970s, and the charge to the Reagan Street Institute was, if digital information can revolutionize appliances, what could better information do for healthcare? It was a challenge to figure it out. In the 1970s and the 1980s, the Reagan Street Institute began, through its research, to develop early databases of clinical information. And they worked a lot with the public hospital, Wishart Hospital, at that time. And Wishart Hospital, by 1990, was actually using a form of electronic medical records as part of its work. And they also assembled a repository for information that could not only exchange data, but could take that data in and analyze it. When BioCrossroads came along, we said, we have a very strong healthcare presence. We clearly have some really interesting abilities in clinical data. Would it be possible to expand this party to be not just about one hospital, but about all of the area's hospitals? And could we, in fact, set up a health information network that would begin to have a unified healthcare system in this part of the state? You've done the same thing here with the Michiana Network. And we did. And today, the Indiana Health Information Exchange, which became self-sufficient, we're very proud of this, within 18 months. In other words, it was no longer supported by philanthropy, it was supported by revenues, and has been ever since. Today, that is the largest health information network in the United States. It recently received a $16 million federal Beacon grant as one of those communities that's going to light the way as the way we practice healthcare gets changed. And we're very proud of that, because if it had, it wasn't, again, that all the assets were already there, all the people were already there, the opportunity was on the table. But somebody had to come in and say to hospital A, B, C, D, to Indiana University, to Reagan Streif, and to others, let's all come together and put something in place that is more than the sum of the parts. And that's what the Health Information Exchange is.
In addition to life sciences, what other sectors do you see as having perhaps the greatest growth potential over the next 10 to 20 years?
I mean, I think you can look at the agenda for the Central Indiana Corporate Partnership, which is our sponsoring organization, and see probably what those strengths are in Indiana. And they divide down along advanced manufacturing or skills-based manufacturing, certainly logistics for this part of the country, and then energy. A lot of people are trying to move very quickly into clean energy, new forms of energy. That's sort of becoming the biotech craze of this next decade. But energy and energy development, alternative energy development, will clearly attract a great deal of funding, a great deal of opportunity, many hits, many misses. This state, I'm not telling you anything you don't know, Jim, this state has a very strong tradition, again, in all forms of energy and commercial energy development. And so I think there will be a very strong opportunity there for us, too.
David, thank you very
much. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thought-provoking and actually encouraging.
Thank you.
Gary Dick is the founder of Inside Indiana Business and a veteran news reporter. Gary says he's optimistic about the economic growth he's seen in Indiana, especially in smaller cities and towns.
I think you can make the case that the Midwest is becoming more attractive to business and industry for several reasons. One, the cost of living here continues to be very competitive, much better than certainly on the coasts and other high-profile areas that typically are much more expensive. So you have good cost of living, generally speaking, quality of life that's really good. It's a good place to raise a family, and more we're seeing not only business executives, the senior leadership, but as those leaders look at their companies and the ability to attract and retain workers, they're saying, we want to go to a place where there is quality of life, where they can raise a family, we all can raise a family, where it's affordable, where the workforce is strong. And I think that's one of the challenging areas is in the workforce area. But in terms of benefits, I think you look at the Midwest and Indiana in particular, we have, I think, made some headlines in recent years for our quality of life, our cost of living, the fact that we have become more innovative, less resistant to change. We're still pretty stuck in our ways, but less resistant to change. And I think that has helped us to attract some pretty big deals in what has been an otherwise tough economy. been a lot of talk about the brain drain. And Indiana does a great job of graduating students from colleges and universities. We have great talent. Too much of it does leave the state. But I really think that is beginning to change somewhat markedly in recent years, especially here in Indianapolis, where if you look at the development downtown, and not just the shops and restaurants and bars and hotels and those types of things, but the arts and cultural attractions that have popped up here, the cultural trail, which is unique, I think in the world to Indianapolis. Those are the kinds of things that now are beginning to get people to come here, young people or younger people to come here and to locate here and to stay here. So I think Indianapolis has done a really good job of mixing not only traditional, downtown development, creating neighborhoods, arts and cultural districts, then connecting them with trails and the things that they're doing. That's a neat thing for people who live here, but there's a real economic tie, and it's beginning to attract people here that wouldn't have probably looked at Indianapolis 10 years ago or more. And I think you're seeing cities like Fort Wayne and Evansville and some other more metropolitan areas around the state doing things like that, looking at arts and cultural types of activities to help attract and retain workers in a workforce. But if you get into the rural areas, and Indiana is largely a rural state, there are real challenges with things like high-speed internet access, things that we take for granted here. If you don't have high-speed internet access, can you imagine trying to run a company or start a company? It's a real challenge. So they face real challenges. However, you do have other people who say rural America is going to enjoy a renaissance of its own, again, back to the cost of living, quality of life type issues that companies are looking for. The question is, do these rural communities have the leadership that is necessary to create programs that really focus on education, which is one of the real K-12 education in particular, one of the real challenges in the state of Indiana, but focus on Indiana or focus on education to make sure there's a qualified workforce and they're doing the types of things to attract and retain companies. I think if you look at the economy, the state's economy right now continues to be tough out there. We're out of the recession technically, but still very much an up and down recovery. I think if you look at central Indiana, Indianapolis has continued to hold its own from an economic standpoint. And I think certainly as you compare Indianapolis to other cities in the Midwest, I think you get around the state one of the big surprises in terms of economic growth. And I've talked to a number of bankers who've said the same thing. And that's in northern Indiana, in the South Bend Elkhart area, which has in recent years caught a lot of headlines for being Elkhart County with the RV industry, for being the highest unemployment area in the entire country. It has really enjoyed a recovery of sorts faster than other parts of the state. The RV industry coming back, some of the so-called green technology industries, think North America, putting their North American headquarters in Elkhart County as well. So you look in the Elkhart County area, they're enjoying some recovery. Lafayette, West Lafayette area is also seeing some nice bump there, as is Evansville. There's a new downtown arena being built in the downtown area. Several corporate headquarters are down there as well. And they seem in Evansville to have weathered the recession perhaps better than most communities and are beginning to come out of it as well. And life sciences, life sciences is kind of the sexy industry, so to speak. And people do talk about it a lot because it's cutting edge, it's innovative, it's new. And certainly Indiana has really has a ton of assets to be very successful in that space. But if you look at some other areas, and this may surprise you, but manufacturing, a lot of people say manufacturing is dead. Well, the fact of the matter is manufacturing is alive and well and will continue to be an important part of the Indiana economy, but it's a different kind of manufacturing. It's advanced manufacturing. So it's not just cars and steel, but it's orthopedic devices and pharmaceuticals. Lilly is a manufacturer. They make drugs. So it's looking at manufacturing in a different way, using knowledge and innovation to grow manufacturing. So you're going to see manufacturing continue to be extremely important for the state. And obviously, we have a lot of people in the manufacturing sector who've worked here for generations. You look in the green technology space with lithium-ion batteries, the most important part of these electric and hybrid electric cars being manufactured with Interdell right here in Indiana. Wind turbines in those types of technologies, not just the wind farms, but these component manufacturers that build the parts to go into those farms here and in other states and around the globe for that matter. And I think there are also some opportunities in information technology, but also more importantly, distribution and logistics. We're within a day's drive of something like 75 or 80% of the population of North America. So we're situated geographically very well. And there's a big push here for distribution, not only through roadways, but also air and other things as well.
That was Gary Dick of Inside Indiana Business. Next time on the Economic Club of Indiana, David Simon, CEO of Simon Property Group. He's the oldest son of the late Mel Simon. Simon became the CEO in 1995 after leading the successful effort to take the company public in 1993. Join us then. The Economic Club of Indiana is a production of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
Proliance Energy, providing natural gas to more than 1,200 commercial, industrial, utility, and municipal customers. Proliance, adding power to energy. Information is at proliance.com.